Available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. I'm Peter Walters, and this edition is being recorded on the 20th of March, 2024. Coming up in the programme, we're hearing about fictional bears of the Pooh Bear and Paddington kind. Also in this programme are Cornish pasties and hot cross buns. There's more from Susie Dent's Dictionary Corner. We're hearing about pet bereavement for guide dogs and others, and all that, plus our usual features, sport and postbag. But first, we're getting the week's news from Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
As we noted last week, new plans for garden waste collection in Coventry are coming, and many people are not best pleased. But for some, with friends and relatives across the Midlands and beyond, the city has had it too good for too long. Coventry City Council plans to charge £40 per year for fortnightly garden waste collection, with those who opt in receiving a sticker to put on their bin to show that they are part of the scheme. Those who opt out will be able to return their garden bin, according to the council. Comments include, "I'll go back to taking my garden waste to the tip, and so will lots of others. It'll cost the council to provide more skips. The crews will have to cover the same mileage to empty the paid-for bins, so there may be no saving, just more fly-tipping. Think again." Another said, "Most people will end up using the green bins for garden rubbish as well as normal rubbish. If that's how the council want to play it, then my garden waste will be going in a bin bag and into the general waste bin. Also, if you pay the £40 and get a sticker, what happens if someone nicks your bin, or if someone who hasn't paid uses your bin?" For some, though, Coventry is just getting with the times. So Coventry is now like the rest of the country. It's pretty standard to get charged on top. Other local authorities have been charging for years. It's a service that isn't statutory. So if you are fortunate to have a garden, I believe we should contribute. Our charge is far less than others pay in neighbouring authorities. A spokesman for Coventry City Council said, "It is our intention to start charging for brown-lidded garden waste bins in June. A year-long permit will cost £40, and residents will be able to sign up from Monday, April the 8th.
Government cash for a long-awaited gigafactory in Coventry is available, the West Midlands Mayor has claimed. Getting the project over the line is now a case of securing private sector investment, according to Andy Street. Supporters of the scheme say thousands of jobs and £2.5 billion worth of investment would be brought to the West Midlands by a new electric battery factory. Local politicians, including Mr Street, have long called for one to be based in Coventry, and a public-private venture for Coventry Airport with the site's owners and Coventry Council was announced in 2021. The site at Baggington has been backed by the West Midlands Combined Authority too. 3 years on, though, the owners of Coventry car firm Jaguar Land Rover are building their battery plant in Somerset. But Coventry is in advanced talks with investors for this autumn. Mr Street said, "We've got advanced discussions with private sector investors who want to do this. All the preparatory stuff to get it to be successful has been done, and we're now in that stage of advanced negotiations to actually land it. Lotus, Polestar and the LEVC are some of the examples of inward investors that have not been held back by the lack of a gigafactory. But we do need the gigafactory, and I'm determined that it should come," he said.
Jaguar Land Rover says it is creating 250 jobs in Coventry and Warwickshire, to help make the next generation of luxury electric vehicles and speed up charging times. The roles include 40 battery engineers who will work across areas including battery cell design and software design. The other jobs span specialisms in propulsion, including propulsion software, calibration and controls, and electrical system component design. The jobs will be based at JLR's Gaydon Engineering Centre and the company's £250 million Future Energy Lab in Whitley, Coventry, where JLR develops and tests batteries and electric drive units. Work here includes testing electric vehicles and batteries in extreme weather climate chambers. Thomas Muller, JLR Executive Director of Product Engineering, said, "The realisation of our reimagined strategy is dependent on our investment in people and technology. As we continue to invest in our facilities, we are now seeking very talented people to help us develop advancements in propulsion technology that will underpin our next generation modern luxury vehicles." Freddie Gunnison, JLR Cell Design Manager, said, "We are ramping up our work, converting cutting-edge science into battery propulsion systems that offer our clients unique driving and charging experiences expected of modern luxury vehicles. This is an exciting opportunity for battery chemist experts to help define the next generation of electrical powertrains."
A Coventry University lecturer's 1980s band has reformed 36 years after splitting up. It all came about after an old release from the band Zanana became a surprise hit with a DJ. Penny Griffiths, 56, works as a lecturer in event management at Coventry University. She formed the electro-pop group Zanana in 1983 with members Anita Tedder and Ruth Elder. They performed in clubs across the country and at the Hippodrome in London before releasing a single called Witches in 1986. The single, though, never charted and the group members parted ways amicably. It wasn't until 36 years later that the band experienced a career resurgence after the record was found in a second-hand shop. Anita and her partner Steph were celebrating their 41st anniversary together on May the 8th, 2022, when the trio did an impromptu performance of the track for family and friends. The very next day, Anita received a message on Facebook from Kiernan Abbott, a Bristol-based DJ who had discovered the 1986 record in a second-hand shop. The song, which draws inspiration from the Witches in Shakespeare's Macbeth, has since become popular on the clubbing scene, prompting the band to re-release an EP. Anita said, "Kiernan found the song was developing a cult following. It has been played in clubs in LA, Paris, New York and Amsterdam. I'm amazed that the whole thing has come through and it's been a great ride. To talk about the music, to hear it again, much less to perform it, really brings the life back into you. We're just really pleased about it. It might all be gone tomorrow, but we've got it for today. To be honest, it really doesn't matter to me what we sell or don't sell. This has been such a great way to tell our story. The video I uploaded of Zanana performing Witches had only 800 views before the EP came out, and last week it hit 10,000. We are doing a live performance at Bedfringe in Bedford at the end of July. We're doing it for the fun and enjoyment. But if ever it doesn't feel like that anymore, we'd stop. Mind you, if Glastonbury do call, we are available."
Police are using cricket in a bid to engage with young people and build community relations. Chance to Shine cricket sessions run in partnership with Warwickshire Cricket Foundation and two local forces and are run each week in locations across Birmingham and Coventry. The aim is to use the sport to break down barriers between police and young people in the region. Sergeant Chris Gallen of West Midlands Police said the sport helped officers earn the trust of youngsters, helping to reduce antisocial behaviour and crime. "Many young people are passionate about cricket in the area," he said. "We're using it as a way to start conversations with them in some of the most deprived parts of the West Midlands. It's no good speaking formally to them as police officers, telling them what they can and can't do. Sergeant Gallen captained a side during a cricket competition at Edgbaston's Indoor Centre. The event was also used to launch Warwickshire Cricket Foundation's Ramadan League season, which is now in its fourth year. Chance to Shine sessions are held every week in Spark Hill, Aston, Lascelles and Coventry.
Plans to lower the speed limit on dozens of roads in Coventry to 20 miles per hour have left some locals wondering how it will be enforced. More than 40 roads in Earlsdon could see their speed limit drop from 30 to 20 miles per hour if a new traffic order is agreed. Earlsdon is set to become the first area in the city to be designated a livable or low traffic neighbourhood, which will see the new speed limit brought in to encourage people to walk or cycle. While some have already dubbed the plan sensible, others say the limits in place at 30 miles an hour are now being regularly broken. One resident said, "Some drivers don't stick to the 30 miles, so good luck with getting them down to stick to 20 miles an hour." A second noted, "It's currently 30 miles speed limit on Albany Road, and we have people going past at 50 to 60 miles an hour on a daily basis. So I really can't see what a 20 limit will do if there's no enforcement of a 30 mile per hour limit. What we need on Albany Road is an average speed check." Others, though, think it's a good idea to lower the speed limit. Seems sensible. It mostly applies to residential side streets that are pretty short anyway, so by the time you've accelerated up to 30, you're often already approaching the end of the road and need to slow down again. Earlsdon Avenue, for example, is quite winding, often busy, and has parked cars on both sides too. Making this a 20 won't add much time to the average driver's journey, and it will definitely make it more pleasant for cyclists. Another, though, joked, "With all the roadworks and cycle lanes throttling traffic in Coventry, 20 miles an hour will actually be an increase."
Lower Cowndon is the second area in the city that could become a livable neighbourhood, after plans for the trial Earlsdon one was agreed earlier this year. The plans will cover an area from Upper Hill Street near the city's ring road to Findford Road near Radford. The idea of the neighbourhoods is to reduce the number of cars on the roads to improve walking and cycling areas. Funding for the scheme in Lower Cowndon was approved on March the 6th, which means residents will have their say on what changes they'd want to see on the streets. Those could be anything from cycle parking to bus gates, traffic filters to lower speed limits. Local councillor Ryan Simpson, the Conservative, questioned the map where the scheme would be introduced in Lower Cowndon, saying the areas offer quite different communities on opposite sides of the railway. He said, "I think if you ask people in those areas how they would make it more livable, you'd be tackling crime rather than going after transport and environmental improvements." Councillor Jim O'Boyle, Cabinet Member for Jobs, Regeneration and Climate Change, says the plans have been watered down when locals realise the implication, and admitted the moves can be difficult and drivers are not always supportive. "If you live on the street you want traffic calming, as soon as you get in the car, woe betide you if you come across any traffic calming where you're driving. And that isn't fair," he told councillors. "It's difficult, isn't it? I think there's always that balance." One Cowndon resident commented ironically, "They have put a cycle lane all along Barker's Butts and hardly anyone uses it. This has made the road narrow, and trying to get out of some of the junctions is dangerous because they have put parking bays and you cannot see oncoming traffic as cars are blocking your view."
Tucked away in Warwickshire is a deserted medieval village that has links to the infamous 18th century highwayman Dick Turpin. Stretton Buskerville is now known as an abandoned village, but historians say that it may have been a haunt for Dick Turpin. It's suggested that the lure of hidden treasure may have attracted him to the village, as gold was reputed to be buried where the village once stood. It's reported that in the 1920s, eyewitness accounts in local newspapers say they saw a ghostly Turpin wearing a black tricorn head and a coat with red sleeves. Deserted villages are famed for being hideout places for criminals, and Stretton Baskerville has a reputation for being used by those who were outside the law. In some cases, lost villages were a safe haven for thieves. The ancient parish sits on the eastern border of Leicestershire, south of Uneaton and north of Burton Hastings. It was known as Straytone in the Domesday Book of 1086. Historians say it became deserted in 1474 when the landowner Henry Smith turned out the residents to turn the land over to grazing. As a result, the church at that time fell into ruin. Despite being known as an ancient parish, the Nuneaton and North Warwickshire Family History Society say that Stretton Baskerville has not had a church or chapel since at least the reign of Henry VII. The village is one of four lost villages in Warwickshire, but the only one which might have been used by a famed highwayman.
Campaigners have expressed joy after the clock ran out on any last-ditch bid that could have ended in Coventry Stadium being demolished. A planning inspector had thrown out plans in January to flatten the historic home of speedway and stock car racing near Coventry, known to many as Brandon Stadium. But that decision could still have been appealed in an effort to build more than 100 homes there, plus a 3G sports pitch. Now such a move is out of the question after time ran out on the 6-week appeal period. It has been confirmed that no legal challenge has come forward. Safe Coventry Speedway announced that site owners and potential developers Brandon Estates had not triggered a last-ditch move that would have involved heading to the High Court. "We are naturally delighted that this marks the end of this process," the campaign said in a statement. "We must once again place on record our thanks to everyone from the sporting and local community who stepped up in such spectacular numbers last summer to assist us with the cost of legal representation. Now questions are being asked what will happen to the site. Brandon Estates, who had been hoping to redevelop the stadium, will need to weigh up what to do with the land. The decision to block the development does not force the reinstatement of its former use as a speedway stadium. Yet, as things stand, some will say there is little prospect of getting any kind of return from the land without it. At this stage, it is too early to give any clear indication of what is to follow, or any timescales," the statement concluded. "We can assure you that with this huge hurdle cleared, we retain an unstinting commitment to get speedway and stock car racing back to their rightful place at Brandon Stadium, and finally bring this saga to an end for the benefit of both the sports and the local community."
The first flying taxis could take to the skies over Coventry in 2 years' time. The Department of Transport has released its Future of Flight Action Plan, which includes the first piloted flying taxis. It also proposes flying taxis without pilots on board by 2030 and would allow drones to fly beyond visual line of sight so the sector can grow without limiting the skies for other aircraft. Coventry has been at the forefront of beyond visual line of sight trials, and only a few years ago the city was set to become the home of the world's first airport for electric flying cars and for autonomous delivery drones, next to the Coventry Building Society Arena. But it's not just flying cars that have been associated with the city. A UK first trial saw air-based medical drone deliveries made between University Hospital Coventry and Warwickshire Trust Hospitals in Coventry and Rugby. Skyfarer Limited, based in Coventry, and partner Medical Logistics UK were behind the medical drone delivery beyond visual line of sight trial. West Midlands Police also uses drones to tackle violent crime and antisocial behaviour. Aviation and Technology Minister Anthony Brown explained that they want to get the infrastructure into place for flying taxis and for emergency service drones. Cutting-edge battery technology will revolutionise transport as we know it, and this plan will make sure that we have the infrastructure and regulation in place to make it a reality. There is hope that Coventry could be one of the homes for this futuristic world of travel. As well as the airport plans and the NHS pilot, the city also hosted a public exhibition of an urban airport for electric vehicle vertical takeoff and landing back in 2022. All this adds further weight to the prospect of the city being at the forefront of what could be the future of transport.
And our final news item is one that you might like to try at home. A well-being guru who makes a living by giving people hugs says people travel from all over the globe to receive her cuddle therapy in Coventry. Professional cuddler Natasha Wicks says that what she offers helps people from all walks of life. The 44-year-old insists that despite criticism, cuddling is scientifically proven to release happy hormones like dopamine. She says a lot of her clients go to her for the kind of emotional support they do not have at home. As such, many of her clients are caregivers, and most of them join Natasha for two-hour hugging sessions, costing £70 an hour. The sessions vary depending on what the client wants, some having emotional hugs, others talking more, and some wanting to sit at opposite ends of the sofa with our legs and feet entwined. Natasha became a cuddle therapist in 2015, and while she has had comments online from people criticising the practice, her family and friends were not in the least surprised when she first started giving professional cuddles. She said, "They all said to me that I give the best cuddles, so it's not surprising that I'd start doing it as a job. It's very much what I do. I help people and want to make people feel better. It's a natural thing when someone is going through a tough time to want to give them a hug." Natasha provides minimum session of 1 hour, but said most people go for at least 2 hours, sometimes longer, if they are receiving more than one type of therapy. "I always give people a hug on the doorstep when they arrive, and then they'll come in and relax, and we'll have an initial chat about what brings them here," she said. "I get lots of clients who are the carers of their families, and they are so busy looking after other people, and probably giving the hugs and support to other people, that they don't have that for themselves. But there's all sorts of people who come for a cuddle. From people who have moved away from home for the first time and just want a mum hug, all the way to people in their 80s. I'm inclusive of all genders and all ages. Working from Coventry is brilliant because I'm only 9 minutes on the train from Birmingham Airport and people come to visit me from all over. I get a client from Belgium, someone from Ireland and people from all over the UK coming to see me for cuddle therapy."
Outlook News.
Thanks very much to our readers, Elaine and Peter. We're all going to rush out and train in cuddle therapy, I think, after that last item. But anyway, we'll move on now with some lighting up time. Sunrise this week, 6:06 a.m. Sunset, 6:20 p.m. And a little note here that says it looks like a lot of cloud for the rest of the week or so. So tell us something we don't know. Moving on again, and here's Hugh with this week's news from the Resource Centre. Hugh.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, last Saturday I toddled along to the Bethel Church in Spon End, where the Heart of England Cooperative Concert Orchestra, or HoEcho for much, much shorter, did a concert of children's works mainly, so things like Peter and the Wolf and the typewriter song, anyway, very light-hearted stuff. There was the Toy Symphony and various other things, and it was an absolutely fantastic concert. And the really, really good thing about out it was. It was jam-packed. It was full to bursting and then some, which was absolutely terrific. The orchestra were absolutely delighted about that because that's the fullest concert they've had since COVID. Anyway, the other really good piece of news about that is that half the ticket sales are going to be coming to us, the charity, so which is terrific news. Now, I'm reliably informed by people what know that we'll be getting about £400 as our divvy of the amount was shared between us and another charity called 191. I think that's the number.
99 to 1.
Oh, yeah, we are. Look, all the right numbers, not necessarily in the right order. So they'll be getting the other half as well. And then we also held a raffle, and we raised another £217 and a penny. It's important. Somebody had a bit of extra change and threw it in just to throw out my figures. But anyway, we're grateful for every single penny, let me say that. So 600 and some pounds from Saturday. So we're tremendously grateful to the orchestra and to the audience who so generously took part in the chocolate raffle. Actually, a nod here to Tesco as well, who supplied a lot of the Easter eggs and everything for us, so thank you to them. But also a specific thank you to Annette Ball, who is a member of the committee now of that orchestra, and who for many years has been our leading the music group. So she was the one who basically organised the concert and persuaded them to support the charity. So thank you so much to Annette. Just a little note on Annette: she's been leading the music group for many years. Sort of alas for us, but great for her. She's got another job on Tuesday afternoons now, teaching at the teaching piano at the University of Warwick in the Arts Centre, which is something she's wanted to do for such a long time. So, with regret and sadness, you know, she has stepped back from leading the music group. However, Claire has been sort of shadowing, taking over, leading the group quite ably when Annette's not been there. So Claire's taking over the leadership of that group, and we're very fortunate, and we have a superb pianist in the shape of Philip King. Hello, Philip, who is helping out on the tickling the ivories. So music group generally in good shape, but obviously very sad to see Annette go. She's not going to leave us completely. She said she's going to come back and help us out at the summer fair and things like that. So we'll look forward to seeing her back again. Now, we had a little pile of leaflets come through the door yesterday to talk about a Coventry book extravaganza. Now, this is not something I would necessarily trouble you with, but it turns out that this book fair, which takes place on Saturday the 6th of April at the Belgrade Theatre, and starts at 10 o'clock and goes on till 4 o'clock, there will be a number of stalls there with large print books, in fact very large print books. So if you are partially sighted and into reading and want to see a different selection of large print books than you may otherwise encounter at your local library, then it might well be popping down to the Coventry Book Extravaganza. It's part of Rosie's Retro Bazaar, which I think is a regular feature at the theatre. So there we are.
Would they have any audio books?
Yes, audio books. They also have audio books. There we are. That was the other thing. Thank you. Yes, a lot of audio books. So, definitely worth going down. They're independent publishers and bookshops, fresh talent and local authors, comic creators and illustrators, literary societies and publishing services, second-hand and antiquarian book dealers, bookcraft prints, paper ephemera, stationery accessories. So, look, it's if you like paper and things printed on paper, that might be a good thing to do on that Saturday. Not as I speak to you, not an hour ago, our new showdown table was delivered. which is now sitting in bits currently in the room where it will be. So we need to put it together and need to put the table together, but we also need to put the activity together as well. Chris is working on that. So the first thing that we will do is, as soon as we possibly can, we will arrange a have-a-go day for Showdown, which, if you haven't been listening in previous weeks, Showdown is a game that was designed specifically for visually impaired people, but it's available to anybody to play because everybody plays wearing blindfolds or, well, eye masks, and it's crossed between sort of air hockey and ping pong, table tennis. So you've got bats that you can shove a ball, but it's supposed to go into a goal, and it's a deep table. Anyway, it looks like a lot of fun. We are going to have a team. We're going to be part of the league. We're going to be the Coventry Comets. We'll get that organised as soon as possible. To be honest, given that we've got holidays coming up, it's probably going to be after Easter when things really get going, but I will make sure I will exercise my bossly authority and require Chris to get moving on that, and I'm sure he will. He's very keen on the whole Showdown activity. So I think that's going to play a big feature in the life of the charity in the years to come. So I'm looking forward very much to that group starting. Just a reminder as well that after Easter we're trying to set up another walking group for Tuesdays, because the Wednesday walking group has become so popular. Peter, who's sitting right opposite me, has been leading that group, and it's, you know, we've been getting a lot of people, and we've got a lot of volunteers as well, which is great, and it's a really, really good group, and, you know, the people who go on the walks absolutely love it. So that's on Wednesday mornings, but anyway, we're going to put another group on Tuesday mornings as well, because it's just, you know, proving supremely popular, and the more people that go for a walk and get a bit of exercise, even if it's a little bit of exercise, the better. It's good for you, and I should be preaching to myself about this point. Now, talking of Easter, we are going to be closed on Good Friday and Easter Monday, so just to be aware of that. So if you take part in an activity, well, I mean, people who do yoga know that yoga is not happening on Good Friday anyway, but neither is Braille, nor indeed anything, no bowls, we're shut. And then on Monday, so there'll be no IT on Monday, there'll be no Monday Club, and there'll be no creative writing on Easter Monday. We've got Jo off, who has been off this week, and she'll be off next week. Cudi is off next week and the week after Easter. Jo will be back in the week after Easter, but I will be off in the week after Easter. So there's quite a lot of juggling around, so you might catch one of us at some point. But there we are. And if you are coming to the centre this week and then in the week starting the 8th of April, I think, you may run into Georgia, who is here on work experience. She's great. She's very engaging. So you'll see her around. So say hi to Georgia. Georgia may well come and say hi to you. Anyway, she's going to be involved with lots of the groups and be doing other little projects around the place as we go. So that's it.
Thank you very much, Hugh. Lots going on, as usual.
There's always a lot going on. There's always a lot more going on in my head that I can never quite get out of it, but there we are.
Thanks for that. I know Sarah is full of excitement with Coventry City winning their FA Cup match last Saturday, which I'm sure she'll be telling us more about now in her sports report.
Outlook Sport.
Well, hello there, lovely listeners. It is a very, very, very happy Sarah here. And unless you've been living in a cave in Outer Mongolia, you probably already know that the mighty Sky Blues, my football club, Coventry City, are through to the semi-finals of the FA Cup, which are played at Wembley. On Saturday, we were in the quarterfinals and we took on Wolverhampton Wanderers. You know, them of the Prem, the Premier League. Premier League. Anyway, it was in front of a capacity crowd, as you can probably imagine. City taking 4,800 supporters. Now, I started off watching the match, watching it being the operative word, because it was on ITV. But I have to say, my eyes weren't the best on Saturday, and I did miss my CWR familiar voices. So I soon switched back to CWR. The first half was frustrating because we had two very, very, very near shots on goal. But Ellis Sims, who has so much been on fire recently, you know, that guy I thought was called Ellie Simmons, he just couldn't finish. Anyway, it went in at half time, 0-0. Shortly into the second half, that Ellie Sims bloke scored. Well, there was then a 5-minute delay because Wolverhampton, being a Premier team, have VAR, video assisted referee. So instead of just going on what the ref and his assistants think on the field, they go and watch it on the television screen. And there must have been a very long deliberation. The key crux was that Sims had basically sort of chested it in, but it was whether it had come off his arm. And although your arm can be absolutely ramrod straight by your side, that would be counted as a handball. Anyway, VAR came back that they could see no reason not to give the goal. So that was it. City were 1-0 up. Wow, we might be going to the semi-finals. Anyway, it all trundled on relatively 50-50 until about the 84th minute when they scored. Extra time it'll be. But no, they scored again in the 88th minute. Now there's 94 minutes plus extra time, which is awarded for things like VAR decisions, substitutions, injuries, play acting, etc., etc. So the 88th minute they scored. At that point, Steve Agrizovich, I think you could say, one of the CWR commentators, sort of put the death knell on Wolverhampton Wanderers because he awarded the man of the match, actually and ironically, to the Wolverhampton goalkeeper. Anyway, there was then an extra 9 minutes extra time. Obviously, 5 minutes of that had come from the VAR decision. Both teams had made substitutions. But I don't think there was play acting, so... Right then, come on, lads. And come on they did. In the 5th minute of extra time, well, that Ellis Sims bloke scored again. Wow. We're going to go to extra time and then penalties. But no, oh no. City had got different ideas of that. And in the 8th minute of extra time, there was a bit of a sort of partnership and a double act between several of our strikers. But the final touch and goal was scored by our American international, Hadji Wright. Stand up, Mr. Wright. You certainly were on Saturday. Oh, so that's how it ended. 2 goals to Wolverhampton Wanderers, 3 goals to Coventry City. and Coventry now go on to play Manchester United in the semi-finals at Wembley. And the amazing thing is, our wonderful manager, Mark Robbins, actually scored in the FA Cup final for Manchester United, which was a goal that was said to have saved Sir Alex Ferguson's career at a time when Man U under Sir Alex weren't doing very well. Anyway, hands off our Mark. We want to keep him. So, were you watching? What were your feelings? Well, I have to say, I let out an almighty groan on the 88th minute when they went up. A cheer when we equalised. And when Hadji Wright scored the final winner, I got off my armchair and I went on my hands and knees and I started beating the armchair and crying. And I am not afraid to say, yes, I cried. Sport just kind of does things to you like that. Well, it does to me anyway. But before our Wembley semi-final, we have to return to normal. Back to the Championship, where we are so much fighting to be in the promotions playoffs. Wouldn't that be fun? Two trips to Wembley. Well, it is if you can get a ticket. Anyway, our next match is on Good Friday at 3 p.m, but that is away to Huddersfield at the John Smith Stadium. Then we are at home to Cardiff on Bank Holiday Monday, so that's the 1st of April. And then the following Saturday, she says, quickly trying to do some maths in her head, that will be the 6th of April. We are at home to Leeds United. That is going to be tough because Leeds at the moment are top of the Premier. But anyway, who can confront the almighty Sky Blues? Now, there was a big match at Leamington on Saturday as well, because Leamington took on Hitchin and won 3-0. Now, that in itself wasn't a big match, but it was the manager's 700th match in charge. Paul Horahan, you have certainly done that team good. I mean, in 700 matches, that is something to really shout about. But sadly, Stratford in the same division lost 1-0. Away. Now, you might remember that last week, or you might not, I told you that Emma Raducanu and Cameron Norrie were still in the Indian Wells tennis tournament. But, as I also predicted, by the time my recording got to editing stage, they were both out. But it was no great shame because Emma was playing the number two in the world, Sabalenko, the Belarusian, and Cameron Norrie had been ill for the preceding 9 or 10 days, hardly able to keep anything down. So yes, you are allowed to be a little parlous. Anyway, the tournament, for those who are interested, was eventually won, the men's by Carlos Alcaraz of Spain, and the women's by Iga Swiatek of Poland. And finally, sticking with tennis, you may have heard of rain stop play, particularly at Wimbledon. I think we've actually at the Australian once or twice had heat stopped play when there's been a real heat wave. But at Indian Wells, it was bees stopped play. You know, those buzzing creatures. Yes, I know they apparently do you no harm, but you really don't want to get stung by them. Anyway, a swarm. Do you have a swarm of bees, a flock of bees, a group of bees, a gang of bees? Whatever you have of bees invaded the court and took a liking to Mr. Alcaraz, who was playing at the time. In fact, he did get stung. And there's this wonderful television clippage of him running to the changing room, batting his racket like mad to get rid of these bees. Anyway, from football to bees, what more could you want? And that has been your sport. Bye.
Here's wishing the Sky Blues success in their semi-final match against Manchester United. Sarah says they haven't got a chance against the Sky Blues. Hope she's right. It's now time for Dave and your postbag, so let's dig deep into his sack for your messages.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there. We start Postbag by welcoming new listener Jag Singh. He first talks about the one-to-one computer sessions at the Resource Centre.
Hi, my name's Jag Singh. I'm a recent user of the IT room at the Resource Centre. Really like the place. John is so helpful, and so is Judith. Heather's so pleasant on the reception. So, thank you to you guys, as well as everybody else there. And I'm a big fan of Compre Talking Newspapers. It's a great source of information on what's going on in our community.
And Jag, who loves the sport and Outlook, has some suggestions for us, which we will hear soon. I'm glad you're getting a lot out of the IT sessions. Julia also enjoys coming to the Resource Centre and says, Monday, Monday, I love that day, because Monday is the day of the Monday Club. They tried having it on other days, but it didn't really work. The speaker this week was the one and only Lord Byron. I thought he wrote poetry and plays and stuff. But it turned out he runs charities and is friends with paramedics. Anyway, one day when he wasn't writing poems, he had a good idea. What he thought if everybody had a green and white plastic bottle. They could write all their medical information on a form and put the form in the bottle and the bottle in the fridge. Then they put a sticker on the fridge door and one on the front door, that's on the inside of the front door, telling paramedics that there's a message in a bottle that tells them what medicine they are on. Lord Byron runs a charity in India too that helps blind people. What a nice man. Monday is my favourite day, but my friend John's favourite day is Friday, because that's the day I give him lots of sherbet lemons, and he doesn't share them with Jessica. That's why he's so fat. Have a lovely week, everybody. Don't eat too many sherbet lemons, or you'll end up just like my friend John. Lots of love, Julia. Thank you, Julia. And Brian, that's Lord Brian, not Lord Byron, of the Bedworth Lions, says the message in a bottle in the fridge could save a life. Either inquire at the Resource Centre about the lion's message in a bottle, or send your details to me, and I'll ask Brian for some, and I'll try and get one to you. And now we welcome back Wendy Pauline with a couple of questions for you.
Hello, my name is Wendy Pauline. I left a note a week last Thursday asking, it was a very short note because I was in a hurry, asking if anyone collected used postage stamps, because I've got a lot. I wondered whether anybody could have mentioned it on Postbag, but I haven't heard anything. I also mentioned, did anybody ever go to watch a stock car racing or even compete in it on the Brinco Road at Binley, not the one at Brandon? I just wondered if anybody knew anything about it. My number is Coventry, 418121. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes, let Wendy know of a charity that needs postage stamps. And have you heard of stock car racing taking place near the Brinklow Road? That's a new one on me. and let Wendy know if you know anything. Derek Headley, referring to the ending of the prescription pod, that's the prescription ordering service, asked recently if the NHS app they recommend you to go onto is visually impaired friendly. Joe Davis, who's been talking about her meeting royals over the last 2 weeks, says she finds the app difficult. Graham Wales says he has an arrangement with his chemist. So it would seem the best idea is to keep doing whatever arrangement works for you, such as with the chemist or the prescription ordering service at the doctor's surgery that I use, unless you have any other advice. Derek has given me this second piece of creative writing for me to read out. It's called My Grandmother's Cupboard. My grandmother's cupboard was not just out of reach, but was always kept locked by a big silver key. The key dangled from a gold chain around her neck, though one day she was forever touching it to reassure herself that the key was still safe. The large cupboard was made from heavy dark wood, looking hundreds and hundreds of years old. On that particular day, to my surprise, the key and chain were laying on the table next to the fruit bowl, full of scrumptious apples, with my grandma nowhere to be seen. So I thought I would take my chance and take the risk and see what lay within. Grabbing up the key, chain, one and all, and I ran to the back room where the cupboard hung on the wall, dragging a chair over to the cupboard, then clambering onto the chair, I reached up to the cupboard and eagerly placed the key in the door. Just then, I heard my grandma shout, "Joseph, is that you?" With my fingers trembling and heart thumping, to my delight, the key turned easily and smoothly in the lock. The cupboard door slid open. At the same time, Grandma came into the back room screaming, "Joseph, don't!" As I swiveled my head to look at Grandma, two giant hairy hands took hold of my shoulders and pulled me in. The cupboard door swished shut, and the key, with the key turning in the lock unaided, Grandma sank to her knees crying. "Not Joseph, not Joseph." Grandma's sobbing was invaded by the ringing of the front doorbell. After drying her tears with the back of her hands, she unsteadily got to her feet. As she was heading to the front door, she took deep, slow breaths to compose herself. Before opening the front door, she glanced in the hall mirror and saw her bloodshot eyes. Picking up a pair of sunglasses which lay next to another fruit bowl full of delicious apples on the hall table under the mirror, donning the glasses and retrieving an apple, Grandma opened the front door. Looking down at a young boy, she said with a calm voice, despite the raging turmoil within, "Hello, Eric, I'm afraid you've arrived just too late to come in today. Can he come back tomorrow?" Eric replied, "Yes, I can, Miss Bramble." As Eric turned to leave, Miss Bramble, slipping seamlessly back into her usual warm, welcoming, cheerful voice, said, "Oh, Eric, don't forget your apple." Eric replied, full of glee, "Thank you, Miss Bramble." While Miss Bramble closed the front door, Eric dashed down the garden path with a huge smile on his face, declaring everything is wonderful in the world. By Derek Headley, of the 18th, 6th, 2022. That's when he wrote that. Thank you very much. And maybe we'll never know what was in the cupboard. Thank you. Very, very intriguing. Thank you very much indeed. Now, from now on, we have an Easter message now for Miss Edwina.
Hi everybody, it's Edwina. Very soon it's going to be Easter. I just thought I would take the opportunity to wish you all a very happy Easter, and hopefully the weather will be a bit warmer by then. And also, for those that are believers, it is an extra special services and full of meaning. So I send you warmest wishes and blessing to you. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina. Finally, friend of the Monday Club, Mark Wood, polo explorer, told you recently that he wants to keep in touch with you during his 100 solo days in the Arctic, where he'll be carrying out scientific tests such as collecting samples of snow to check on pollution. He arrived in Resolute Bay in northern Canada in the Arctic, preparing to take on his challenge when he was hit by bad weather. Here he is.
Well, we were planning a route today, and we were looking at a place where I went to with Top Gear. If I went further north than this position we're looking at, it's quite bad open water, so it's quite dangerous in the first week, and there's potential that, you know, something could happen. So I'm going to go overland, and the place where I'm going to go through is called Polar Bear Pass. But I went through that route already, as I say, with Top Gear 2007. It's just crossing land for a little bit, and then I'll be heading back down on ice again. So the first probably 10 days is going to be crossing land.
Mark, while waiting for a broken sledge to be fixed, stayed in an Inuit hunter's hut on Cornwallis Island, part of an archipelago of Queen Elizabeth Islands in a frozen Arctic sea, before setting out on his 1,600-mile solo journey via Polar Bear Pass, with the next food drop 30 days away. He is outside the hut to get a better signal in the bitter cold, about minus 30 degrees, as he speaks to you.
How do I feel at the moment? I feel scared. Scared about what I'm getting into, but, you know, this is things like this change your life as a person and your perspective on life. So, you know, I'm about to jump in the deep end, really, and it's only just beginning, but I'm trying to fix my mind into an adventure rather than it being painful each day. You've got to embrace these things. See the adventure, the good side of things rather than the bad side. I think that's what I'm getting from it. I'm fine, and yeah, I am happy, immensely happy, but I've got a long journey ahead of me, so I try and be honest with people. I'm happy, but I'm in fear as well, so yeah.
And Mark has invited me to phone him up and interview him out on the ice, which I will try to do. If you want to listen to his daily reports, click on to Radio Solo 100. We wish Mark well. Keep safe. So here ends a varied and ending up very exciting postbag. Please let's hear from you next time. Thank you for your messages this week, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Bears have often featured in fiction. Two that immediately come to mind are Pooh Bear and Paddington. But there are many more, and here Lynn Bensley takes a romp through his favourite bears in fiction. This is from This England magazine, read by Elaine.
A teddy bear is the most comforting of creatures. There is no other toy as steadfast and dependable, or more likely to become both our confidant and playmate. There are few toys that survive the rigours of childhood and accompany us into adolescence or old age like a teddy bear, that reassuring talisman who deserves our unconditional love. I still possess my own teddy bear, imaginatively called Ted, who was bought for me by a dear aunt for my third Christmas. The same kindly soul also bought me my first Rupert Bear Annual when I was 8. Mary Tortell was already an established artist and children's book illustrator when she created Rupert for the Daily Express at the behest of her husband who worked there. The Daily Express were mindful of the need to run a comic strip to compete with their rivals. The first episode, entitled The Little Lost Bear, appeared in the newspaper in November 1920. It would eventually prove even more enduring than Teddy Tail in the Daily Mail and Bobby Bear in the Daily Herald. Tortell's artistic style was original as her storylines. Upon first meeting Rupert, we learn that he lives in Nutwood, a quixotic village hidden in the heart of England, set in no definable time. Together with his pals, we follow Rupert on a host of mysterious and magical exploits amidst water fairies and wood trolls. By 1935, Rupert Bear was seen as a national treasure. But with failing eyesight, Tortell decided to retire, and former Punch illustrator Alfred Bestel was appointed to take over. Under Bestel, Rupert adopted his red jumper with yellow check trousers and matching scarf to become one of our most instantly recognisable comic strip champions. Advised by the children's page editor to avoid evil minions, fairies and magic, Bestel aimed to construct storylines more firmly anchored in realism. This, however, did not prevent him from taking occasional flights of fancy or from introducing a diverse array of characters. These included the old professor, the Chinese conjurer and his daughter, Tiger Lily, Gaffer Jarge, the Sage of and Sailor Sam, as well as an inventive dog named Bingo that some fans likened to Bestel himself. Another much-loved bear was introduced to us in a roundabout way by A.A. Milne in 1924. The poem was simply entitled Teddy Bear. 2 years later, now living in the woods under the name of Saunders, we again encounter that bear of little brain in a book of short stories about himself and his best friend, Christopher Robin. That first volume gave Winnie the Pooh considerable standing in a world far beyond the confines of the 100-acre wood or the expectations of his creator. A second volume, The House at Pooh Corner, further advanced the fame of the tubby teddy, who did almost no thinking about anything in particular except honey and how to procure it with minimum effort. When not preoccupied with the business of bees or the bearable buoyancy of balloons, Pooh liked nothing better than to explore the wood with his plucky pal, the philosophical piglet. They would hunt for heffalumps, seek the woozle that wasn't there, or track awesome paw prints in the snow. Pooh, in short, as indeed he is, has scaled the dizzy heights of Disneyland and conquered the hearts and minds of millions. Swapping honey for marmalade, the idea for Paddington Bear first came to Michael Bond on Christmas Eve in 1956. He saw a teddy bear sitting forlorn upon a shelf in the toy department of a London store and bought it as a present for his wife. Bond was working as a cameraman for the BBC, but he had been writing in his spare time for over a decade. In the spring of 1957, he decided to write a series of adventures about the bear he named after the railway station nearby where they were living at the time. Within 10 days, he completed A Bear Called Paddington, introducing the world to that marmalade-loving migrant with the hard stare who hailed from darkest Peru. Befriended by Mr. and Mrs. Brown and their two children, Paddington soon finds life at No. 32 Windsor Gardens very much to his liking. but in trying to do his best, he usually brings out the worst in others. Kindness and politeness are his watchwords, but his belligerent neighbour, Mr. Curry, always thinks otherwise. But it was perhaps the stop-motion animated BBC series made by Filmfare in the 1970s, narrated and voiced by Michael Hordern, that made Paddington a household name. Performing as the character led Hordern to admit that God, Lear, and Paddington had proved three of his most challenging roles.
And Elaine will complete that look at fictional bears next week. Last week, Bill started telling us about the unusually pink-painted Spitfires used for low-level reconnaissance in the last war, and now completes that story.
At the start of the war, the RAF did not have a modern photo-reconnaissance aircraft. Long-range reconnaissance was meant to be handled by Denim bombers, short-range by the Lysander Army Cooperation aircraft. Neither were suitable, as they were far too vulnerable to enemy fighters. In October 1939, two Spitfire MK1s were given to Cotton. These were the first of around 1,000 Spitfires eventually converted or scratch-built for the reconnaissance role. This unarmed fighter would roam as far as Berlin, providing the RAF with a vital capability throughout the war. Cotton was soon running the number one photographic reconnaissance unit, PRU, at Helston Aerodrome in West London. As the war progressed, the PRU was equipped with aircraft specifically designed for reconnaissance. The submarine Spitfire, PR Mark VI, was unarmed, with its guns replaced with cameras. It could reach altitudes exceeding 30,000 feet and achieve speeds of over 400 miles an hour. The PR Mark VI photographed the famous Moen Dam, gathering intelligence on the success of the Dam Busters raid in 1943. Other triumphs include the sinking of German battleship Bismarck on May 27, 1941. 6 days after a high-altitude PRU Spitfire flight located it moored in Grimsdalsfjord, Norway. The only two remaining airworthy PR Mark VIs, PL-965 and PL-983, are also displayed in the Spotlight exhibition. Also on view for visitors is the pale-green Lockheed Electra, which Cotton actually flew on his secret spying missions. Cotton reputedly came up with the idea for the colour of the aircraft, says Shaw. It's a sort of light green colour. Cotton felt the colour provided very good camouflage. Supposingly, he saw similar aircraft which took off from Hendon, and he took the colour from that. He completely duped the Germans during the war, and people on the ground found it hard to spot him as he flew about in this very well-camouflaged aircraft. Cotton relished his reputation for being unconventional. The PDU became known as Cotton's Crooks because he had so many run-ins with top brass officers. He even had a badge made called CC-11. 11th commandment was, "Thou shalt not be found out." Ultimately, some 80% of all wartime intelligence came from aerial overflights. Cotton also developed the light blue colour, utilised for the high-level reconnaissance Spitfire, which made them very hard to see during the day. Along with several of those blue Spitfires is the Westland Lysander Mark IIIA, which was built at the Westland Aircraft Factory in Yeovil, Somerset. It was fitted with so-called stub wings, carrying small bombs. While some 225 Squadron V9312 flew some 30 photo stories, sorties. After a complete restoration, it flew again in 2018. On the walls of the giant hangar at Oxford, videos of flying missions flown by many different aircraft are played, creating a unique atmosphere for visitors. There are also blown-up black-and-white images of some of the snaps taken on sorties. Several shots show the Army Research Centre in Peenemünde, Germany, where V-1 and V-2 rockets were developed to strike terror into the civilian population of England. Another shot shows heavy bomb damage inflicted at the Melsbrook airfield in Belgium after a raid by RAF Bomber Command on August 15, 1944. Landscape is pockmarked with bomb craters, showing the devastation of the raid. Runway was put out of action, and nearby buildings seriously damaged, inflicting a heavy blow against the Luftwaffe. Another shows how the Germans tried to protect the Dinard airfield near Saint-Malo in France. False hedges are woven into the landscape to make the airfield look as though it is just a series of fields. The cunning plan did not fool our war leaders. Detailed photos showed the landscape was fake and that the Germans had even managed to paint a road on rough ground. A shot of Boulogne in 1940 shows many barges were in the harbour. War planners thought they might be used as part of an invasion of Britain, but most would have sunk during the attempt to storm our shores. The exhibition will shine a light on a lesser-known aspect of the secret flying operation, our very brave pilots and photo interpreters give our war planners the edge deciding how to defeat the Nazis, adds Shaw. It is unique because, for the first time, we have tried to tell a story of the crucial work done by our spies in the skies.
It's deceptive how effective camouflaging can be. Cornish pasties are one of those great comfort foods, identifying their origin in their name. Nigel's been looking into these unique little pastries, originally the staple of Cornish miners.
It seems that we all love a Cornish pasty. This heritage recipe, which began life more than two centuries ago as a handy lunch for West Country tin miners, is now a national favourite. Last year we polished off more than 120 million of them. Our appetite for them generates an estimated £300 million of trade for the Cornish economy each year. It's no wonder, then, that the recipe, featuring the four permitted filling ingredients of skirt steak, potato, swede and onion, is closely guarded by a protected geographical indication status. That being said, we're not averse to bringing a few changes. To fit in with modern demand, you can now pick up a vegan and gluten-free pasty, while a visit to one admittedly Devonian pasty maker unearths flavours as diverse as chicken and chorizo, Moroccan lamb and vegetable curry. While these variants aren't allowed to be sold as Cornish pasties, they do underline the fact that the basic pasty template, as with any pie, is eminently adaptable, a great user-upper of whichever ingredients are at hand. It's not only Brits who like a nice pasty. Rio del Monte is one of Mexico's highest towns, almost 9,000 feet up in the Sierra de Panchua, in mountains in the state of Hidalgo. At first glance, its well-attended town square seems like any other Mexican Zoalco. But take a closer look and you'll notice something strange. Is that the black and white standard of St. Piran, the flag of Cornwall, fluttering in the breeze? There can't be a real telephone box in the corner. And what's the deal with a shop-off-shop dispensing what looks very much like Cornish pasties? The answers to these questions are rooted in the region's history. In the 1820s, Mexico had been ravaged by its War of Independence, which had left Hidalgo's lucrative silver mines derelict and flooded. The Mexicans needed expert help to reopen them, so they applied to the tin miners of Cornwall, who brought with them their know-how and their state-of-the-art steam-powered equipment. Back then, the miners' journey was a lot more hazardous than it would be today. when the first 130 Cornish men, women and children landed at Vera Cruz in 1825, they had to traverse 400 kilometres inland to Real del Monte on foot, hacking over upwards through dense vegetation, lugging their 1,500 tons of equipment with them by rope and on mules, a trek that took more than a year. Over the course of the 19th century, these intrepid pioneers were joined by more expats, fleeing their countries by then dwindling tin industry, establishing a thriving Cornish presence in the High Sierra. The Englishmen brought with them more than professional acumen. They also introduced football to the country. The miners' afterwork kickabouts eventually coalesced in the founding of Mexico's first official team, Club de Fútbol Panchura, set up in 1901 by men from Red Ruth and Camborne. Both towns are now twinned with Real del Monte. The sport soon caught on. It is now the country's most popular sport, and Mexico is one of the only five nations to have hosted the World Cup since, that's in 1970 and 1986. But it's the pasties that remain Real del Monte's most vivid Cornish legacy. Called pasties, pronounced paste, they are made as the same way as those you'll find in Cornwall, right down to the trademark hand-crimped edges. Fillings, though, have been varied in accordance with local tastes and ingredients availability. A pasties del airport, one of around 70 pasty shops in Real del Monte and the neighbouring town of Panchura, varieties include the spicy chocolate and chili mole, tinga de pollo, a chipotle marinated shredded chicken, and zarzumosa, concresso, blackcurrant and cheese. "We don't get many British visitors here," says Asirio Peralta, a former miner who set up the shop in 1975. "But Mexican tourists love our pasties." One British visitor, who did put it in an appearance, was a rather eminent one. H.M. the King, then HRH Prince of Wales, visited the town's pasty museum, Museum del Paste, in 2014, and the King isn't the only famous Brit to have dropped by. When Paul Hollywood visited in 2022, the town's bakers organised a bake-off, proffering their finest pasties for his appraisal. Tactfully, he decided it was handshakes all round, and the contest was declared a draw. Other signs of the British influence of the town include the Pantheon Inglese, or English Cemetery, where many of the original Cornish miners are buried in graves that all point northeast to the mother country, and the occasional Anglo-Saxon surname. Panchuca-born Ricardo Ludlow is the great-grandson of Christopher Ludlow, who arrived from Camborne in 1875. He recalls his mother and grandmother making pasties when he was a child. "Each one would be personalised with our initials in pastry," he recalls, "but we wouldn't have any chili in ours." He also has fond memories of Cornish breakfast. "My grandmother would fry up yesterday's pasties, which we would eat in the morning with scrambled eggs." It wasn't until he visited the UK a few years ago that he realised this thrifty tradition was no longer practised in Cornwall. As the years passed, the Cornish men and women of Real del Monte became Mexican. They still had to practise Methodist religion in private, says Ricardo, but gradually they fell in love, married and had children. For those who did so, integration was quicker, easier and happier. The tale of Real del Monte's pasties is one of assimilation, of something from overseas, suffused by local influences to create something new and distinct. Neither Cornish nor Mexican, yet both.
From the origins of Cornish pasties to the origins of words and phrases, from Susie Dent's Dictionary Corner with Margaret.
Dictionary Corner. Fuddle Caps Hall. At this time of the year, all memories of hairs of the dog have faded, and the end of dry January can't come soon enough. An eager return will be made to the pub as quafftide, the season for drinking, begins again. The historical dictionary can be helpful when it comes to drinking and its consequences. Among many names for the pub, for example, are the Snifting Shop and Boozerium from the early 1900s, and wonderful Fuddle Caps Hall from the 1600s, the source, presumably, of some befuddlement. Drinking types also come in different guises, not all of them happy. They include the lick spigot, the person who always turns up as you're opening the wine, and the shot clog, the unwelcome companion tolerated only because they're buying the next round. High days and holidays. In the calendar of the Christian Church, there were once two sorts of special day, a high day and a holiday. A holiday is a shortening of holy day and first described a date set apart for religious observance. A high day was an even more important day of great celebration and solemnity, commemorating a sacred person or event. Together, these give us the term high days and holidays for special occasions collectively. A red letter day, meanwhile, denoted a saint's day or other Christian festival that would be highlighted in red in the calendar. One word that many of us won't be looking forward to is hollybobs, a cutesy, relatively new slang term for holidays that was recently voted the most hated buzzword by British office workers. Hot dog. Sausages have been dubbed dogs in the US since the mid-19th century, probably as a joking reference to the meat they might contain. The use of hot dog for a frankfurter or wienerwurst in a long, soft roll is thought to have originated in the slang of Yale University students in the mid-1890s, thanks to continuing suspicions about the meat. Later, the term was probably helped along by the visual similarity between a frankfurter and a dachshund, that is, a sausage dog. In a less plausible but colourful explanation, Bavarian Anton Furtwängler reportedly sold hot sausages at a trade convention in 1893, offering customers gloves to protect their fingers. But when customers kept the gloves, it said he substituted elongated rolls instead. Numpty. Almost a decade ago, the Oxford English Dictionary appealed to the public to find a printed record of the word numpty, dated earlier than 1985, which was the first usage they had documented at the time. A member of the public duly found an example dating from a year earlier, but that was trumped by academics from King's College London, who found evidence of the very similar word numpy in a spoof playbill from almost 200 years earlier. The advert for an imaginary farce features a character named Numpy the Third, a teasing term at the time for a cuckolded husband. It is thought that a T was later added, thanks to the influence of the nursery rhyme Humpty Dumpty. Both versions of the word derive from numps, a 16th century term for a simpleton.
I know many of our listeners have their wonderful guide dogs, and I'm sure many others have a pet as a companion. Unfortunately, they don't live as long as us, and a recent study on pet bereavement showed that 85% of owners report loss and grief symptoms comparable to the loss of a family member. Patricia Noble talks about how losing her dog floored her in ways she couldn't imagine, and how she managed to see the light and help other owners through their bereavement.
My dachshund Dougie and I had a very close bond. He was my shadow, my constant companion, and my soulmate. My husband Alex and I don't have children, and Dougie came to us as a puppy and became our family. I suffer with chronic migraines, and just before one would begin, he would come padding over to me and then cock his head to the right, sit at my feet and look at me in a certain way. The first time he did it, I thought it was a fluke, but it wasn't. And he started knowing, the split second before I did, that I had a migraine coming on. He really picked up on my emotions, and if I wasn't feeling my best, he wanted to be close to me in some shape or form. You do hear stories of dogs being able to sniff out cancer and other human illnesses, and the bond humans can have with this species is amazing. Animals can be like permanent children, because you always have to care for them. They're not going to grow up and get a life of their own. So when Dougie died, I went through the full experience of pet loss in a way that I never expected. In 2020, my husband was walking Dougie on the beach, and Dougie's back gave way. He'd already had a back operation when he was a year and a half old, and we knew he may need another one someday. But then, at 11 years old, and with a heart murmur, it wasn't looking good for another operation. So we had to make the heartbreaking decision to let him go. It happened so quickly. At 10 a.m. he stopped being able to walk, and he was gone by 4 p.m. I spent the first 2 months in a daze, and then fell quickly into a deep depression. I was at the blackest point I've ever been in my life. There was an absolute hole in my psyche, and my foundations had been knocked away. Such was the intensity of the pain, I cried every day for 6 months. I would see another dog and cry rivers and waterfalls. I found it difficult to mix with people. I remember about 3 weeks after Dougie died, someone at church telling me they were so sorry to hear about my loss, and I could feel my tears leaking through, despite trying so hard to control them. I managed to sit through the service, but the moment I got into the house, for the first time in my life, I howled, a deep primeval sound. I remember thinking the neighbours would hear me, but I couldn't stop. Because of the intense agony of the loss, all I could think of was that this life wasn't worth living. I contacted the Pet Loss Support Helpline at the Blue Cross and emailed a volunteer at the service every 3 weeks for 8 months. At that time, I wouldn't have been able to talk to anyone, so this written communication about my grief became a lifeline to me. The thing that helped me the most was being given the affirmation I needed that it was okay to feel this loss so deeply. For a while, everything was measured in terms of how many days, how many weeks, how many months since Dougie's death, and I was always looking back. But then I was able to imperceptibly turn my head around and start looking towards the light. I started to cry less, and when I saw a dog owner, I would shed a tear but also be able to smile. Society doesn't always understand pet loss. If you lose a husband or a wife, nobody says, "Oh, well, never mind, there are plenty more men and women out there. Go and get another one." When you lose your dog, some people say, "Well, there are lots more animals to adopt in rescue homes." You do want to throttle those people. Society expects people to grieve for certain people and not for other species. Yet the depth of loss, one feels, is about the shared bond, and people can have similar stages of grief with their animal that they have with humans. You can feel guilt. Did I do something wrong? Could I have changed the outcome? Did I love them as much as I could? Anger. Perhaps the medical profession should have done more. The feelings can be the same, they're just about a different species. When my deep darkness began to lift, I decided to become a volunteer to help other bereaved pet owners. just as I'd been helped. It didn't surprise me the first time I heard from a caller who said, "I'm grieving more for my animal than for my brother when he died. It doesn't make sense. Am I a bad person to feel this way?" Someone may look at that and think, "What? You've lost a human and you feel more for the dog?" But the reality is that for some people, their siblings have moved away and made their own lives, and their dog or cat may be with them day in, day out for years, and you're spending time with them and investing in them constantly. I've had people ring me for support because they are floored by their grief over a tiny lizard. Initially, I thought, this is an animal I don't know anything about, so how can I help this person? But it's not about the lizard, it's about the bond. If this person feels this way about an animal, the type of animal is not significant. The grief itself is what matters. They're entitled to feel what they feel, and they should be allowed to have the space to express that. My advice to anyone trying to support someone who is grieving an animal is this. Be sensitive and aware that this is not like losing a set of car keys. An animal can be a family member, so even if you don't personally understand that bond, give them the same care as if they have lost a human. As a society, we certainly forget, or perhaps don't accept, that grief for an animal can be profound. If you're an employer, try to cut the employee some slack and be aware that they may not be at their best. Give them some space, but make sure they know they can talk about their loss if they want to. And for heaven's sake, don't tell them to pull themselves together, because it can take weeks, months, or years for someone to feel better. Grief doesn't have an expiry date. And of course, never, ever tell them to just go and get another dog or cat. They may well get a new animal, but it will take a long time to build up the bond and trust they had with the pet they've lost. 4 years on from Dougie's death, we haven't got a new dog, but we have been adopted by the next door cat, Max. My husband and I seem to have been chosen by him, and he comes into our house, eats our food, and receives cuddles. I will always remember Dougie and miss him terribly. But as I wrote in a poem about the loss, "Yet I would love again and face this awful pain, for living without love is living life in pain."
It's always a sad time when we lose a faithful pet. In just over a week, we'll be celebrating Easter. And one of the traditions associated with Easter, beside those chocolate eggs, is hot cross buns. Sheila came across this article in English Heritage magazine.
"Hot cross buns, one a penny, two a penny buns, one a penny, two a penny hot cross buns," now echoed in a familiar childhood nursery rhyme. These words were first the cries of 19th century street sellers. As dawn broke on Good Friday in Georgian London, the cobbled streets would begin to fill with sellers, old and young, male and female, who competed to win customers with their loud exclamations. Carried in wicker washing baskets and kept warm with a cloth covering were rows of these special once-a-year treats. Sweet, fluffy buns, flavoured with allspice and marked with a cross, scoured into the dough. From as late as the end of the last century, the cross on hot cross buns has instead been added with flour paste, short crust pastry or icing, but it remains as a hint to the religious origins of this Eastertime indulgence. By the 18th century, hot cross buns were explicitly associated with Good Friday, a key date in the Christian calendar, commemorating the crucifixion of Christ. As was seemingly common, one writer from 1773 recorded eating tea and cross buns for breakfast on Good Friday before going to church, and spending the day in religious study. To those practising their faith today, a bite from a hot cross bun on Good Friday can still be an act laden with religious significance. The bread is a nod to the communion wafer, the spices represent the spices Christ was wrapped in his tomb, and the cross is of course a reference to the crucifixion. It wasn't until the 18th century that the tradition emerged of eating hot cross buns similar to those we might recognise today. Before this, with few written records or recipes, the origins of the hot cross bun are uncertain, contested and veiled in myth. Some maintain that we can trace its roots to the crust bread that was made by the ancient Greeks, while others suggest that we better look at the Jewish custom of sharing unleavened bread at Passover. Across many cultures, ordinary bread has long been made special, often with the addition of dried fruits or other sweeteners to mark important festivals. Think of dried fruit studied panettone at Christmas or the Easter Columbia bread from Italy. Some historians maintain that the hot cross bun dates back to pre-Christian times, when special currant bread was baked in honour of the Saxon goddess of spring. Eaten hot and perhaps dipped in a layer of honey, the sumptuous cakes were fitting for the hopefulness and abundance that comes with a change in seasons. As ancient custom merged with Christianity, it is from these Easter celebrations that we even get the word Easter, and perhaps along with the hot cross bun, the holiday's association with eggs and the Easter bunny. Zooming forward in history, another theory puts it that we find the original hot cross buns with medieval monks, who stamped their special bread at Easter time with a cross to commemorate the religious importance of the occasion. Sometimes this is attributed to a 12th century monk, at other times to the 14th century monk from St Albans named Thomas Rowcliffe. The so-called Alban bun was made with flour, eggs, yeast, currants and expensive spices. Imprinted with a cross using a knife, the lavish buns were supposed to be distributed to the poor at the gates of St Albans Abbey from 1361. And St Albans Cathedral still makes Alban buns each year. In the Elizabethan era, controls on the size, shape and price of bread sold meant that London bakers could only make spice cake, buns, biscuits or other spice of bread for burials at Christmas or on the Friday before Easter. Though we can't be sure they were marked with a cross, this reference does suggest that specifically spiced buns were made on Good Friday. Under Elizabeth I, England was still transitioning from a Catholic to Protestant country during the Reformation, and has been suggested that the Elizabethan order to control these early versions of hot cross buns was for fear that they were too Catholic. Unlike the Protestants, Catholics believed that the communion bread miraculously and literally transformed into the body of Christ at the consecration. These magical properties were attributed to Good Friday buns because they were associated with the blessed and cross buns distributed by some Catholic churches on Good Friday. But maybe it was a hangover from Good Friday's Easter sepulchre, which celebrated the miraculous potential of bread to the delight of churchgoers. The hot cross bun has meant different things to different people throughout history. It's no surprise then to see its meaning changing in the present day. Though it's still associated for most with the spring or Easter season, it's possible to find a mass-produced hot cross bun at any time of year. And there are modern additions to the recipe too that obscure the religious symbolism of the traditional ingredients. How about chocolate and orange, white chocolate and lemon, apple and cinnamon, or even banana and caramel? These are just some of the varieties found in UK supermarkets. Whether you're tempted by these adventurous flavours or a traditionalist when it comes to holiday food, a hot cross bun is a fascinating and delicious way of connecting to the values and beliefs of the past.
And that tasty treat, preferably with lashes of butter, ends this edition of Outlook for another week. We'll be back next week, but the following week we're taking our own Easter break with no programme on 3rd of April. Until next week, from the team and me, Peter Walters, it's goodbye for now.